afternoon. I'm not entirely sure how much time we have for this talk, but since I've never given this talk before, I'm also not entirely sure how long it's going to take. So I'll start, and when I run out of things to say, we'll start Q&A until they ring the bell on us. The title of the talk, as you know because you signed up for it, is Being an Ivri in the Age of the Smartphone, Standing Apart from a 24/7 Culture. I embark from the premises that there is a great deal that is wonderful and indeed profoundly enriching about the world of technology, the internet, and even the immediate access to the internet in the palm of our hands in which we find ourselves, and at the same time that it poses enormous challenges to us. I think that in the world of high school education, we think that this is the single biggest challenge that we are dealing with right now, both because it brings together in it, and we'll talk about this a little bit later on, a lot of different strands of that which we struggle with, and also because of its ubiquity, its ever-presence. There are other challenges that we confront sometimes and set aside at other times. We're worried about the kids partying and what they may do when they party, but that's actually confined to certain times and certain spaces. We're worried about other kinds of issues, the college craziness and its impact on our kids' mental health, religious lives, intellect, and a lot of other things. But even that within the college, within the high school experience is somewhat confined. This is not confined. This is everywhere and it's everything and it's all the time. And for those reasons, I think that when you ask educators what is the biggest thing that we're trying to figure out how to get our arms around, this is it. And the third reason I think why this is the biggest thing we're trying to get our arms around, not only because it brings so many things together in it, and again, I will delineate exactly what those things are a little later, not only because it is ubiquitous everywhere all the time, but precisely, as we'll also talk more about, this is not something to which our message is just say no. It's not like teenage drinking, where our goal, whether we can succeed in it or not, our goal is ultimately just get rid of it. That's not our goal here, and that leaves us in a much more challenged position. And so to talk about being an Ivri in the age of the smartphone, I actually want to talk first about the age of the smartphone, then I want to talk about being an Ivri, and then I want to bring them together. So to begin, I have really no particular patience for this kind of narrative. This was a headline, a cover story in the Atlantic Monthly a few years ago. Is Google making us stupid? What the internet is doing to our brains? I really have no patience and no use for this kind of narrative because the internet is not making us stupid. The internet is opening up access and avenues in ways that we have not had before. Those of us who are teaching in classrooms where there is Wi-Fi and where the internet is a presence in our classrooms know the many ways in which, in a day-to-day way, this enriches our teaching and students' learning. I used to have a standing offer to my students when I started teaching. If you ask a question to which I do not know the answer, and you find and bring in an answer, that's extra credit. That worked at the beginning of my teaching career. If a student asks a question to which I do not know the answer, all of our fingers, well not mine because I'm trying to teach, but all of their fingers get busy Googling, and 10 minutes from now, someone is probably going to have an answer. I remember one piece, this is totally irrelevant, but just fun, one piece of information where this happened, all the way at the beginning of my teaching career, a student asked me about the nuclear football. You know what the nuclear football is? The nuclear football is that briefcase with the nuclear codes that goes around handcuffed to a Marine's wrist wherever the president travels. The nuclear football goes with him or her so that the president needs to launch a nuclear attack at any moment they have the nuclear codes with them. And a student has asked me more than 15 years ago, asked me, why is it called a football? And I said, I have no idea. Go home and find out. It'll be extra credit. And she did. And it was. How she found out before an age of Google, I don't know. But the answer, in case you were wondering, is because the briefcase is made out of leather, and originally it was passed back and forth between the Army and the Navy, so leather object passed back and forth between the Army and the Navy. By analogy, that became the football, which is still what it's called. So that experience now happens in real time. A colleague of mine teaching Tanakh was talking about teaching her class. We had this conversation last week. Was talking about teaching her class the parasha in the Torah about Egla Arufa, that if you find a dead body abandoned between cities and you don't know who's responsible for the murder, the leaders of the city measure which city is closest, break the neck of a calf, right? That's the whole parasha. And the parasha of Egla Arufa is found in the middle, embedded in a broader discussion of war and the laws of war and going to war. And so she raised the possibility with her class that some Mefarshim raised, that in a time of war, when we loose some of the normal bonds of civilization on what we can do and what we can't do, murder may become more prevalent. And that perhaps is why this topic of Egla Arufa is found in the Chumash within a broader discussion of the laws of war. Well, one of her students opens up his device and starts doing a little bit of research in class as to whether in the United States murder rates have spiked following on major wars or major conflicts. The fact that we have access to a great deal of information is also changing what teaching is about, although I will say pretty bluntly that we as schools, as institutions of learning, have not yet caught up with this change. If you figure this change is about 20 years old, our teaching and learning doesn't yet reflect this reality, which is that to be a teacher is no longer to have a monopoly on information that I give you and you write down in your notebook and now you know it and on the test you give it back to me. That's a pretty useless exercise because I don't have a monopoly on information. Information you want, you will always have access to. A much more valuable exercise today is to say to you, there is an immense deluge of information out there. How do you know what you want? How do you know what you trust? How do you sort it? How do you attach credence or not to what you find out there? That's a much more valuable exercise than my saying to my students, I will now tell you who Henry VIII is. Please write this down in your notebooks. For telling them who Henry VIII is, Wikipedia does a better job than I do. For teaching them about how to think about what's out there, I do a better job than Wikipedia does. When I taught European history every year, I would show my students the website for the Institute for Historical Review. Oh, that sounds like a very, smart group of people doing smart stuff. I don't know what they do, but it sounds smart. They publish a journal. It's got all footnotes and journal formatting and layout. It's a Holocaust denial outfit. That's what the Institute for Historical Review is. They do Holocaust denial. But they lay it out nicely, and they put in footnotes, and they published a journal, and they gave it a neutral name. I don't know. I found this journal on the internet. It's got an article, right? How do you judge, assess, sift, sort? That's what our education has to start being about, not let me give you more pieces of information that you did not have. We are still working as educators, as institutions, to get our arms around this. We're doing it to some extent. We're not doing it yet as much as we need to be. But the enterprise of education is going to change fundamentally as a result of the advent of this technology and the universal access that we all have to it. But when people sit around lamenting the, you know, yonder days of yore, the bygone days when it wasn't like this, I think that when the printing press was invented, I have no doubt that there were monks lamenting the passing of the scriptorium. The scriptorium was a lovely room where lots and lots of monks sat copying over text. And I am sure that when the printing press was invented, there were a couple of generations of hand-wringing about our students' lack of mastery that they get from actually writing the text by hand, and what a virtue memorizing is, and how lazy they're going to be now that there are books. I mean, we know this exists, and we have these sources. It's not just my speculation. These sources exist. How lazy they're going to be now there are books, and they won't have to work at anything. And it's really pretty much the same argument a few hundred years later. And obviously the answer is not to do away with books and to make us go back to writing. The answer is to realize that books open up new avenues of learning and new opportunities for engaging with the world that you didn't have when you didn't have books, and the same is quite true right now. There are in the room here current colleagues, former colleagues, parents of students, people I know from all my parents, people I know from all different areas and connections and walks of life. But one of my a former colleague here, somebody who's been very interested and committed to integrating technology into the classroom, this is your attachment. And I'm now showing you something very interesting about technology integration in the classroom. A few years ago, something blew up. It went viral on EdTech Twitter. And what went viral on EdTech Twitter was this hashtag PencilChat. And what PencilChat was a whole bunch of technology integration experts who are working to integrate technology into the classroom, talking about how we would talk about pencils today if they were introduced into the classroom, and the kind of resistance they would meet from teachers because of the bad uses to which they could be put, and the ways they couldn't be controlled, and the dangers that they posed. And for those of you who remember, everybody's favorite technology from about 5 years ago, so this is a throwback, this is an extra normal animation about pencil chat, and I'm really starting to worry now because it seems like I may not have sound. Do I have sound in here? I do not. Yes, I do?
Let me dive.
Can you put on the captioning, please?
Sure. While we do that, let's put on the captioning. Okay. And then, are we going to have sound?
No. I don't know.
Okay. We'll leave my extra normal animation for a minute while we figure out if we have sound. Let's try one thing, though.
How's the L?
That's the one thing I wanted to try. If not, that will work. Nope, it's not. Okay. Maybe the pencil will break and I won't be able to find the pencil technician to fix it. Pencils are sharp. What do I do if one student uses a pencil to poke another student? When students use pencils in class, they may be distracted and draw other things. A student used a pencil to write a mean thing about another student. A student used a pencil to draw an inappropriate picture. QED, we shouldn't have pencils in class. And obviously the point of pencil chat, aside from being a joke, was to say that any new technology brings with it challenges. We use pencils in class despite the fact they can be used to doodle, make inappropriate pictures, and poke other kids. We still figure out how to use pencils in class. And similarly, we're going to have to, I'm enjoying watching the sign language using a pencil to poke other kids. Similarly, we're going to have to figure out how to integrate these technologies into our classroom in meaningful ways. They do pose challenges, and nevertheless. I want to say one more thing about what technology can do for us beyond the classroom, and then we'll shift from the age of the smartphone to the IVRI. It is almost a commonplace nowadays to rank on social media, to talk about how they trivialize, to talk about how they distract, to talk about how they absorb us. I'm Instagramming my breakfast. I'm updating my Facebook friends that I walked out my front door. I'm tweeting about nothing. It happens to be there's such a clear age thing. I'm cool with Facebook. I'm cool with Instagram. I tweet all the time. I don't Snapchat. It's so clearly a dividing line generation by generation. How far are you social media and then where you stop? I stop at Snapchat. My kids think that Twitter is like for their parents, yeah, and Facebook is for their grandparents. It's one generational how these things work. So it makes sense. I'm born at the age of my students' parents, right? My son is an 11th grader in MTA. So it makes sense that I tweet and I don't Snapchat. All those critiques can be true, but all those critiques are actually missing something, which is that social media in the best ways democratizes our access to voices to which we would not have had access before. It affords platforms to people who would not have had platforms. The public editor of the New York Times in today's New York Times is writing about the enormous lack of racial and ethnic diversity in the New York Times newsroom today and how white the New York Times is today, right? So even the liberal New York Times is almost entirely white. And that means that there are other voices that simply do not have access to platforms in our national discourse. And I really don't usually ever do this, but I'm about to do this. Whoops, let's go back to my slideshow. I'm about to do this. This is actually a tweet storm of mine, a thread of tweets from the summer. A break from tweeting about the election, which is mostly what I was doing all summer, to tweet about Twitter. Usual knock on social media is that it reinforces our silentness, right? We're each in our own silo. We only hear from others like us. Echo chamber. Not my experience. Twitter has given me access to voices I wouldn't otherwise hear. Black Twitter. Black Twitter is the term that is used overall for the collective African American voice on Twitter. Black Twitter has given me firsthand, unmediated access to voices of African Americans I wouldn't have had otherwise. And by shutting up and listening, I have learned a great deal. So you may or may not remember that a black woman named Sandra Bland was pulled over driving in Texas. She was driving down to Texas moving for a new job. After an altercation with a police officer, she was arrested, put into jail for a traffic stop, was left in jail for 2 or 3 days, was found hanging in her jail cell. The death was ruled a suicide. Her family said nothing about this makes any sense. She was moving to Texas for a new job. She was very excited about it. She would never, doesn't matter, the death was ruled a suicide. Twitter, if I die in police custody. And the hashtag, if I die in police custody, was all about, it wasn't a suicide. I didn't do it. It was done to me. Tell the truth. Now here I am, a white person in America. I have never, I've been pulled over in traffic stops. The thought has never crossed my mind, ever potentially, that any encounter I have with a police officer could ever even potentially end with my death, nor did I give a second thought to what happens if I die in police custody. But here is a cross-section of black America tweeting about if I die in police custody, because it's something that at least possibly once crossed their minds. And that's an important thing for me to have access to learn about, to hear, and I never could have or would have before social media. So when we talk about the, you know, Instagramming your breakfast, letting your Facebook friends know you've walked out the door, there is also great value to the voices that social media give us access to that we might not otherwise have had access to. I think that the past 6 months, year, year and a half has also taught us that when we give platform to voices who might not otherwise have a platform, we hear all kinds of voices that we actually find ourselves very uncomfortable hearing. We might not have wanted to hear, we may not want to hear, but it nevertheless may be valuable for us to know that those voices are out there. So that's about technology. And that is all to say that I have no use for the narrative that technology is terrible, horrible, and ruining our brains or our kids' brains. I really don't. I learn a lot through social media. I think my students can at least learn a lot if they choose to. So that's technology. Now let's talk about being an Ivri. Chazal say that Abraham is called Ivri because the whole world is on one side and he's on the other side. He is identified by this identifier as being on the other side. But here's the interesting thing, of course, and I say this wholly unoriginally. The point has been made many times before in many drashot, particularly in modern Orthodox shuls. His other sideness is not a turning away from and not a closing off from. He is on the other side as he engages with, as he encounters, as he sits in a tent open on four sides, welcoming passers-by and talking to the world. And so he's figuring out how to be, as Rabbi Sacks so eloquently put it this morning, right? He is in the world. He is not of the world. He is engaging with the eternal while he is very much embedded in the contemporary context in which he lives. Abraham's inherent Ivriness is not an Ivriness, it's not an otherness of being apart from. It is an otherness of being within and yet in a certain profound sense being countercultural. So I grew up in an open-minded intellectual home within a black hat yeshivish context. I was certainly educated very much in black hat yeshivish settings. I think it was certainly less than a decade ago before I ever would have identified myself as modern Orthodox. But one of the things that, as the thought passed through my brain, I realized I was going to have to claim the label of modern Orthodox, whether I particularly thought I wanted it or not, or whether it fit so comfortably at that point or not, was when I realized that I had learned powerful lessons about emunah, about faith, from two Catholic nuns. I think if you're learning lessons about faith from Catholic nun, it's time to face the fact that your mom wrote that. I'm not going to talk to you about lessons about faith or the Catholic nun. That's my lead in to talk to you about Russell Moore. Russell Moore is a senior figure within the Southern Baptist Convention. Specifically, he is the head of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention, which means he is sort of the intellectual and policy-setting figure for the Southern Baptists. The Southern Baptists, I do not have to tell you, are a very conservative religious denomination. That's who the Southern Baptists are. And Russell Moore found himself in an interesting place this past year or so, because Russell Moore was ardently, vocally, emphatically never Trump within a religious community and a religious culture that was overwhelmingly supporting Donald Trump. And Russell Moore laid out his broad argument, not his narrow argument about contemporary politics, but his broad argument about how religious people have to be in the world, and something called the Erasmus Lecture. You can look it up online. It's either available as a YouTube video, First Things published the entire text of it. And in the Erasmus Lecture, he talks very powerfully and very effectively about this idea of religious people not doing exactly this effect, which Rabbi Sacks spoke about this morning, which is assuming, you remember the Yellow Pages? So there used to be an ad for the Yellow Pages. If it's out there, it's in here. So I can't even say that to my students without backing up and explaining to them what the Yellow Pages are. And at that point, it's not even pointful. And I just say that modern orthodoxy doesn't mean if it's out there, it's in here, without the cultural referent, because you know what the Yellow Pages are. Mostly, you're old enough that you remember what the Yellow Pages was. If it's out there, it's in here. So Moore is talking about it in one kind of context. He's talking about it specifically about engaging with politics. I obviously want to talk about it here more in terms of engaging with culture. The assumption that if it's out there, it's in here, is a very problematic one. That's not what the enterprise of modern orthodoxy is supposed to be about. And the idea of Avraham being an Ivri, in the world, engaged with the world, and yet apart from the world, is, I think, very much what we are called to do here in this area with this particular set of questions. And I actually don't think that there's anything harder to do it with right now than this. Again, because of the ubiquity, the everywhereness, the difficulty in turning away. And when we talk about the ubiquity, the everywhereness, the difficulty in turning away, another thing I'm not a fan of, there's lots of things I'm not fans of. I'm not fans of technologies making us stupid. I'm also really, really not a fan of kids these days. Kids these days with their smartphones and their Facebooks and their, you know, kids these days. Not a fan of kids these days. If you talk to parents about their kids, most parents will tell you their kids spend too much time on their phones and with their technology. If you talk to kids about their parents, an even greater percentage of kids will tell you that their parents spend too much time on their phone and on their technology.
There you go.
All of the evidence tells us that this is true. If you don't believe me, go to any playground and watch the parents in the playground with their kids. All right, this is homework assignment. Go to a playground and watch the parents in the playground with their little kids. I do it too. I'm also in the playground. My little kids doing the same thing. We're all in the playground doing this, right? And at the dinner table and at everything else. So the ubiquity of technology is not only a kids these days problem. It is an all of us in the way we live problem. And let's not pretend that this is a problem for the 15-year-old. It's a problem for the 50-year-old every bit as much. You might not be Snapchatting. You might be doing something else. But it's a problem every bit just as much. And so for all of us, because all of us are drawn in, are spending so much time engaging with our devices, the question of in this particular context how to be an Ivri is even more challenging, even more pressing, even harder. So one approach to dealing with this would be the approach that the Haredi world has more or less signed up for, and that is the approach of attempting to wall off. No smartphones, limit internet access, the approach of trying to wall off. I don't want to talk right now about why that approach will or won't work. There is something facile and kind of gross and useless about sitting around telling another community what it is doing wrong. I have no interest in engaging in that enterprise. We are not choosing to do that thing. That is an approach. Whether that approach is going to work for that world or not is its own conversation. It's not our conversation. We're not doing that. But you know what? At least they have an approach. When the Asifa happened at Citi Field a few years ago, you remember that big gathering of tens of thousands of people coming to Citi Field to... So my modern Orthodox students thought that this was the single dumbest thing that they had ever heard. You had a gathering of a whole bunch of people together tonight at the internet. So I said to my 11th grade students, I have a question for you. Do not answer it. I don't want the answer. I'm asking you a question. Do not answer. How many of you has ever seen hardcore pornography? Don't answer. Okay. When I was a kid, nobody ever saw hardcore pornography. We didn't not see hardcore pornography because we were frummer. We didn't see hardcore pornography because in order to get it, you have to go into one of those movie theaters that, as my husband would say, was, you know, was muktzamach masmias, and the people in it, and the whole thing, right? I don't have to go into any detail. You all understand, and you weren't going anywhere near it, and you weren't getting exposed to it, so you weren't getting exposed to it. Every kid you hand a smartphone to without a filter has access to that, which is why the research tells us, now granted this is in the broader world, not in our community, but still, that the average age of first exposure to pornography is 11. Well, that makes sense, because what's the average age of a smartphone? So that's a world that's at least engaging. And if that's a solution that we don't think is going to work for us, we have to figure out a way to engage. But saying, ha-ha, the Luddites, and where are they going to go smash the mechanical looms? Well, what are you doing about confronting, dealing, and addressing with a challenge that is no less a challenge? I'll tell you another story that tells us how far back the question has been pushed. An incident arose in our school this year, at the beginning of the year, that gave us reason to think that we needed to address some of these issues of phones and phone use and what was being done on the phones in the ninth grade. But then we stopped and we said, well, it's the third week of the school year. So if we need to address the issue in the ninth grade, the third week of the school year, it's not really a ninth grade problem because they came into ninth grade with those smartphones. Okay, I'm in a high school now that has an attached elementary school. So we obviously have to deal with this in junior high, the sixth to eighth graders. We need to talk not only to the high school parents, but to the junior high school parents. Guess what? Within the space of 2 or 3 weeks, you know sometimes that happens, that you have a question and within 2 or 3 weeks the answer comes to you from three different places. Within the space of 2 or 3 weeks, a story from a parent about something that happened on a school bus, a conversation that I had with a woman who's a Rebbetzin in Bergen County, a conversation that I had with a woman who's a Rebbetzin in another community on Long Island, all three of those sources of information said to me the same thing, which is the average age of getting a smartphone is fifth grade. You can't even have the conversation in middle school. We need to be having this conversation in our elementary schools. We need to be having this conversation in our elementary schools. And you're right, when your kids are in elementary school, you look at them and you say, my sweet little 10-year-old. I'm just talking to my 10-year-old about yuck and ach and gich. Well, if you're handing them an unfiltered smartphone, I don't know how you think you're avoiding having that conversation, right? We have a really robust program in SAR High School for teaching 10th graders about health and sexuality. And half the year it's in a Beit Midrash curriculum. We look at Torah sources. We talk about Jewish values around sexuality. And half the year it's a health curriculum and they learn health. And part of what we do is we bring the parents into school one evening. And we say to parents, here's what we're teaching your kids. Please, you also go home and talk to your children about this, because more important than us shaping your kids' values in these areas is you shaping your kids' values in these areas. I'm not joking. Two parents of 10th grade boys said to me this year, I haven't spoken to my son about this, and by this we mean pornography on the internet, I haven't spoken to my son about this because I didn't want to give him any ideas. Honey, your son has had a smartphone, presumably without a filter, for the past 3, 4, maybe 5 years, and you think that if you go home now and talk to him about internet pornography, you're going to be teaching him something he didn't otherwise know? Okay, so we can say the Haredi world is barking up the wrong tree, and that's all fine. I have no interest in having that conversation. Are we barking up a tree? And if not, we should find ourselves a tree to start barking up, right? Let's find the right tree. Okay, great. So, pornography, however, is not the only issue here, and I want to be very clear about that. I said all the way in the beginning that smartphones for us, that the ubiquity of internet access, the wireless everything everywhere, is the biggest challenge we as educators face, precisely because it's not one thing. It's not just pornography. It's a lot of different things all in one place. So it is that too. It is bullying and all the different kinds of nastiness and ugliness that goes on social media that we, the adults, have no access to. When a kid is mean to another kid in the building, I have at least a chance of finding out about it, of knowing about it, of addressing it. When the grade forms a grade WhatsApp group on their own, the kids create a WhatsApp group, and no adult has any access to that WhatsApp group, and they're talking to each other in whatever ways and posting whatever they're posting on that WhatsApp group, that is a totally closed circle that I have no access to. I don't know what's going on in there, and it could be good, it could be not good, it could be all kinds of things. For those of you who are active on social media, you know that in general the tenor of communication on social media gets very brutal very quickly. There's a disinhibition when we don't see the human being on the other side. We forget that there's a human being on the other side, and it's, you know, all guns blazing all the time. And teenagers are less developed beings than adults are, so kal vachomer. So that's an issue. With girls, you know, we talk about it, when you talk about this with boys, you end up rapidly going down the path of talking about internet pornography. When you talk about it with girls, you're talking about a whole different set of issues. You're talking about body image. You're talking about how they portray themselves. You're talking about how they get responded to. You're talking about the curating of pictures and images they put up of themselves and what they look like, and then the responses of all their friends are, oh my gosh, you look amazing. That's always the response to girls' posts on social media. You look incredible. You look fantastic. The girls think that the use of, okay, filters and Photoshop, and right, you're not just putting up an unmediated picture of yourself because you have to have the right picture looking the right way and seeing what kind of responses you get. You haven't gotten any response, and the anxiety around that. What does that mean? What do people think of me? So when we talk about social media, that's a whole other conversation we're talking about. And then the ugliness that is often directed at girls and women online. So that takes us down an entire other path of conversation. The Shabbos question, right? Are our kids so absorbed in this world that they can't unplug for 25 hours, or the temptation not to unplug for 25 hours is so great? Just the general distraction, right? I can't get any homework done because I was about to start my homework, and then I went down the rabbit hole of any one of many different rabbit holes, whether it's the rabbit hole of social media, or it's the rabbit hole of Netflix, or it's the rabbit hole of an online chat with my friends, or it's the rabbit hole of whatever rabbit hole I went down, and now it's 1 o'clock in the morning, and my work is not done, and I'm hysterical and in a panic, particularly for kids who are challenged with focus, who are challenged with executive function. When you have this distraction to end all distractions in front of you. So that's yet another issue that we're dealing with. I have to say that I don't personally find this to be an enormous issue that we contend with, although it's out there as well, the concern about violent video games and what repeated exposure to those does to kids. I can't say that's something that we find ourselves doing a tremendous amount of worrying about, but that too is an issue. So the smartphone is everywhere and all the time. It is potent and attractive. It brings together in it a lot of different challenges, a lot of different questions, and for all of its potential, we have to figure out how we're dealing with some of those challenges. Great. I scared you all. I said all kinds of, I started off with good stuff, now I got into all the terrible, horrible, scary stuff. Now what? I actually think there are some real now whats. The, you know, what can we do? Throw up our hands and sort of despair. I don't buy that either. So let's talk about the now what. The first now what is that as parents and educators, we have to get our heads out of the sand. We have to know what we're dealing with. We have to understand it as well as we can. We all do the chuckle, chuckle, ha ha, my kids know how to use this stuff better than I do. I do it too. But you have to have at least some understanding of what it is, right? You have to understand the basic differences between how Instagram works and how Twitter works and how Snapchat works. So you understand what's going on when the kids come and tell you A and B and C. Do I have to follow you in order to see what you post? Do I have to be your friend in order to see what you post? Can I private message you, or is everything public? You have to have some basic understanding. I will tell, again, this gets back to parents who think that their sweet little children with unfiltered smartphones are having no exposure to anything and it's all good. It's not all good and they are being exposed. I won't say the biggest red flag, but a big red flag for me is when a parent says to me, so now I'll tell it to you, so at least you'll never say it to me, when a parent says to me, I'm my daughter's best friend. Ooh. She tells me everything. Ooh. No, you're not, and no, she doesn't. And sometimes the best way to snow you is to have you think that you are and she does, because then you're not asking any questions. you're really, what a mother says to me, I'm my daughter's best friend, she tells me everything, that's my best indication that she doesn't know what's going on. Because she thinks she knows what's going on, and she's not asking questions. What asking questions means, how that looks, we'll talk about that in a minute. But you're not your daughter's best friend, and if you were, that's also not the role we're aspiring to. We're trying to be their parents. But that to me is a red flag, because that's an indication of a certain kind of head in the sand, is that, oh, my daughter tells me everything, I know everything that's going on, which then doesn't lead any place good. I think those are the school bells, not our bells. I'm going to keep going until they tell me to stop. Okay. Next, and this directly segues into my next point. We got to be prepared to be the parents here. We have to be prepared to be the parents here. And figuring out what that means is not easy. I'm not pretending that it's easy. But, oh, everybody else in sixth grade has a smartphone, so it's self-evident that you should have a smartphone is probably not what's called for. It might be everyone else in the sixth grade has a smartphone. I don't think that I either want to make you suffer the social stigma of not having a smartphone, or I want to fight that fight. But your smartphone is going to have really robust parental controls, a filter, limits, whatever it is, right? I'm not talking about forcing our kids. I heard about Yaakov Horowitz, who actually presented in the first session, speak a few weeks ago at the YU Rebbetzins conference. YU runs really outstanding programming for Shul Rebbetzins. 100 Shul Rebbetzins from all over the country get together and wearing a different hat. My husband is the rabbi at Mount Sinai Jewish Center, so I get to go to the Rebbetzins conference. And the Rebbetzins wanted to speak to Rabbi Horowitz about what if we're in a community, an out-of-town community, a community whose standards might be different on whatever issue it is than our standards. Rabbi Horowitz actually made a very emphatic and I think troubling to the Rebbetzins call for not making your kids be too different from the families around them, because that can induce resentment. And I think the Rebbetzins were hoping to hear a message of, well, if you empower your kids with a sense of, then they'll be fine. And he said, if everyone else in the neighborhood lets their kids play ball on Shabbos and they're all outside, and your son is sitting inside with his nose pressed up against the glass, wanting to go outside and play ball on Shabbos, that's not a good place to be. But that does not mean either total capitulation. That's what being a parent is about, right? It means saying, okay, given the circumstances, given the school I chose to put you in, given the community we live in, given the realities around us, and also given our family's values and my concerns and my obligation to be a parent, how am I going to figure out how to navigate this thing, and here maybe is a way. And I want to say another thing about as we figure out that way, and that is, I think it's less effective, and I say this not from any expertise, either in parenting or in technology, but just from my own having done it. I think it's less effective to hand down pronouncements to your kids than it is together to work out shared understandings. And that's for two reasons. One is just if you let your kids collaborate in establishing the rules, what time at night do you think it's reasonable to give back the cell phone? They may be more likely to go along with them. But the other is, you will hear from your children how much they think you are a part of the problem, which means that you too then subscribe to the same rules you're laying out. So if we say no phones at the dinner table, it's not no phones at the dinner table for kids, it's no phones at the dinner table for nobody. I am telling you that when I talk to my students about texting while driving, my students say to me, we sit in the carpool and try to get our parents to stop texting while they're driving. Oh my kids are saying this to me. Now you're telling me it's not true about all my kids. Some of my kids are texting while they're driving. I'm sure that's true. Some of their parents are not texting while they're driving. Also, I'm sure that's true. But I have kids who are saying to me, we're sitting in the back of the car trying to figure out how to get the grown-up to put down his or her phone while the grown-up is driving the car. You know that's true. You know we are crummy examples to our kids in a lot of these areas. And so shared discussion of norms is not only, if I don't impose it, you know, by force, if we work it out together, my kids will be more willing to listen to it. It's also shared discussion of norms as we're all in this together. A very smart colleague, and I don't remember who, I would quote my very smart colleague by name, when my son, who's now a junior in MTA, got an iPod for the first time. My kids do not have smartphones. We live across the street. My son has to walk across the street to go to school. Like, you don't need Waze. You don't need a cell phone. He has a dumb flip phone, but he does have an iPod. So when my son first got his iPod, before he got it, I said to him, the deal for the iPod is it gets locked up for Shabbos. And my son said to me, what? You don't trust me on Shabbos? And I said, I trust everybody about everything. The deal about getting an iPod is that it gets locked up for Shabbos. And a colleague of mine said something that was so smart and that now we do. She said, or he said, I don't remember who it was. Don't make it you take away your kid's device for Shabbos. Make it there is a place where devices get parked for Shabbos. There is a family norm that we all stick with that devices have a parking lot for Shabbos. Because it's not something I'm imposing on my kid. We all together, we have a desk on the other side of the apartment, as far away as you can get in a Washington Heights apartment, and right before Shabbos, all the devices get parked on the other side of the apartment on the desk for Shabbos. And then after Shabbos, we retrieve our devices. So it's not about telling which child they can't have what device. It's about a norm, whether it's like that in terms of Shabbos, whether it's in terms of the dinner table. I'll say it in terms of filters, right? We're going to put filters on our kids' internet. You may want the filters on our internet to be less filtered, to be blacklist rather than whitelist, to have looser controls, to have more access, to have everything else. But at a fundamental level, there isn't a particular reason not to. And if it's about, so I'm going to tell you a story about my parents now, about my mother while she sits here, and about the world I grew up in and about the world I work in now and about all of this. When I was 13 years old, VCRs were then a thing. A friend of mine, a neighbor down the block, got a VCR video of Dirty Dancing, which was rated PG-13. And I was growing up in that Haredi world, and I knew perfectly well I wasn't supposed to go watch Dirty Dancing, which is why I didn't share with my parents that I was planning to go down the block to the neighbor's house to watch Dirty Dancing. My older sister, the rat fink that she is, snitched and told my mother that I was going down the block to the neighbors to watch Dirty Dancing. At which point my mother told me I couldn't go and sat me down and had a conversation with me in which she said, it's not about you. It's not about you're too young to watch this. We, as a family, with our values, what we do, this is not what we do. We don't watch movies like this. So it's not about, because I remember saying, well, it's PG-13 and I'm 13, right? That's every 13-year-old's first argument. It's not about you. It's not about you being too young. It's about our values and what we don't do. So years later, I was working in a modern Orthodox high school with a colleague and close friend, and I told him this story, and he said, oh, growing up, Dirty Dancing was my mother's favorite movie. That was about, you know, worlds colliding. But I'm not telling you can't watch Dirty Dancing, or your kids can't watch Dirty Dancing, you watch whatever you want. I'm only saying that that message, a message not of it's prohibited for you, but this is what we as a family do, and this is what we as a family don't do, is much more likely to be effective. If you say to your teenager, that stuff is not okay for you, it's only okay for grown-ups, that's the first most likeliest way to get your teenager to want to find out whatever the that stuff is. That's not okay for them. It's only okay for grown-ups. I have no idea when this bell is going to ring, so I'm going to briefly summarize and stop and then take questions, comments, and feedback. The whole enterprise of being modern Orthodox, and with the greatest respect to Rabbi Dr. Lord Jonathan Sacks, I do use that term, is to be in a state of you know, sitting on a medicine ball. Have you ever sat on a medicine ball and you, like in an exercise class, and you weeble and you wobble to try to stay on the ball? It's very good for building up your core muscles, but it's kind of unnerving. That's the whole enterprise. It's not an enterprise of saying if it's out there, it's in here. It's not an enterprise of saying we're going to wall it off as much as we can. We recognize the tremendous value it has to offer and it has to contribute. I really do. I think that's totally clear. I also recognize the many, many, many challenges it poses in navigating in a healthy, appropriate, committed Jewish kind of way. And I don't think it's hopeless and helpless. I think there are things we can do. I think we need to have our heads out of the sand and be really aware of what we're dealing with. I think we as parents and as educators need to be prepared to be the parents and to be the educators, not to be so uncomfortable playing the heavy, not to so much want to be the good guys, not to so much want our kids to like us, you know, that we buy the piece with a cheap and easy short kid, you could have what you want. And at the same time, both for the just for the reason of I think it's more likely to be effective in getting kids compliance, but also for the deeper reason that we as adults also need to wrestle with these issues. Family guidelines around these issues should not be handed down from parents onto kids as mandates for the kids, but should be collectively arrived at conversations and guidelines about what we as a family do around this, what are our family values around this, as a way of hopefully securing greater compliance from your teenagers and even preteens to the extent that they have access to this technology, but also, frankly, in establishing appropriate and healthy limits for us as adults in the way we interact with this technology and giving us our dinner times back. Thank you. Questions, comments, ideas, things people want to say? Sure.
Great morning. But from a learning theory point of view, do as I say, not as I do, has been proven doesn't work. And that's, I think, what you're saying. Just right. Been proven over and over.
Yes.
I really like your thing about not handing things down by fiat and arriving at, you know, family values or family standards or whatever. But is there not occasionally a point where you say, I'm the mommy, that's why, that they can have a certain amount of input into this process about, you know, parking devices or whatever it may be. At some point, may you not actually have to put your foot down?
Absolutely. I'm the world's biggest believer, and I'm the parent, that's why, is an answer. I think that's a perfectly good answer. I don't think we should be shy about giving that answer. But it works better when your kid is 6 than when your kid is 16.
Oh, absolutely.
And it works better when it's about why we have to go home from the playground now where we can have 12 marshmallows and 3 hot dogs for supper than it works with why I can tweet during supper, but you can't Snapchat during supper. So I think there has to be a I am all in favor of, because I'm the parent and I said so as a reason for things, but I think we also have to acknowledge that our teenagers are young adults with functioning brains. They actually have points to make. And the thing, and here I will end, the thing that most in the whole wide world pushes teenagers' buttons is hypocrisy.
Oh.
The sense that you are not doing what you profess, that you are not living up to what you say, that is the thing that most gets teenagers going. And I think that the real truth is that as adults with our smartphones, we are very often not doing what we say. And here is a place, I think, where I'm the parent and I say so has to pull back a little bit to hear the validity of our kids' critiques
Absolutely.
Of us and to acknowledge it and to say, you know what, kids, this is a big thing. And we're all sort of figuring out how to deal with it. And we are going to figure that all out together. Thank you very much. Have a wonderful day.
Tell me it's on the desk.